5. The conflict between Christian truth and evolutionary philosophy. Now we must look to see what orthodoxy says about the question of evolution, where it touches upon philosophy and theology. According to the theory of evolution, man is coming up from savagery, and that is why books show Cro-Magnon man, Neanderthal man, etc., looking very savage, ready to beat someone over the head and take his meat. This is obviously someone's imagination. It is not based upon the shape of the fossils or anything else. If you believe that man came up from savagery, you will interpret all past history in those terms. But according to orthodoxy, man fell from paradise. In evolutionary philosophy, there is no room for a supernatural state of Adam. Those who want to keep both Christianity and evolutionism, therefore, are forced to stick an artificial paradise onto an ape-like creature. These are obvious two different systems which cannot be mixed. What finally happens is that the people who do this, including many Catholics in recent decades, see that they have become mixed up and therefore they accept that evolution must be right and Christianity a myth. They begin to say that the fall of man is only a fall from cosmic immaturity, that when ape-like creatures, being in a state of naivete, evolved into human beings, they acquired a guilt complex, and that is the fall. Furthermore, they come to believe that originally there was not just one pair of human beings, but many. This is called polygenism, the idea that man came from many different pairs. Once you give in to the idea that Genesis and the origin of man must be inspected rationalistically, on the basis of the naturalistic philosophy of modern thinkers, then Christianity has to be put away. Naturalistic philosophy is a realm of relative truths. In the teaching of the Holy Fathers, on the other hand, we have truths which are revealed and are given to us by God-inspired men. In the writings of the Holy Fathers, there is a great deal of material about evolution, although one wouldn't think so. If one thinks through what evolution is philosophically and theologically and then looks up those questions in the Holy Fathers, there is a great deal of information to be found. We cannot go into much of it right now, but we will cover a few points in order to characterize evolution according to patristic teaching. First, we should note that, according to the Holy Fathers, creation is something quite different from the world we see today. An entirely different principle is involved. This goes against the thinking of modern Christian evolutionists, under quotation marks. One such evolutionist, the Greek theologian, under quotation marks, Panagiotis Tremplis, writes that it appears more glorious and divine-like and more in harmony with the regular methods of God which we daily see expressed in nature, to have created the various forms by evolutionary methods. End of citation. We will note here that oftentimes theologians, under quotation marks, are quite behind the times. In order to apologize for the scientific dogma, they often come up with things which the scientists have already left behind, because scientists are reading the literature. The theologians, under quotation marks, often are scared that they are going to be old-fashioned or say something which is not in accordance with scientific opinion. So, often they can quite unconsciously fall for an evolutionary idea by not thinking the whole thing through, by not having a thoroughgoing philosophy, and not being aware of scientific evidence and scientific questions. The idea that Panagiotis Tremplis sets forth, that creation is supposed to be in accordance with the methods which God uses all the time, has certainly nothing to do with patristic about it, because creation is when the world came into being. Every Holy Father who writes about this will say that those first 6 days of creation were quite different from anything else that ever happened in the history of the world. Even Blessed Augustine says that the creation is a mystery. He says we really can't even talk about it because it's so different from our own experience, it's beyond us. We simply cannot project present-day laws of nature back into the past and come up with an understanding of the creation. Creation is something different. It's the beginning of all this and not the way it is now. Some rather naive theologians, under quotation marks, try to say that the 6 days of creation can be indefinitely long periods, that they can correspond to the different geological strata. This, of course, is nonsense because the geological strata do not have 6 easily identifiable layers, or 5 or 4 or anything of the sort. There are many, many layers, and they do not correspond at all to the 6 days of creation. So that is a very weak accommodation. As a matter of fact, even though it looks as though it might be terribly fundamentalistic to say it, the Holy Fathers do say that those days were 24 hours long. Saint Ephrem the Syrian even divides them into two periods, 12 hours each. Saint Basil the Great says that, in the book of Genesis, the first day is called not the first day but one day, because that is the one day by which God measured out the entire rest of the creation. That is, this first day, which he says was 24 hours long, is exactly the same day which is repeated in the rest of creation. If you think about it, there is nothing particularly difficult in that idea, since creation of God is something totally outside our present knowledge. The accommodation of days to epochs does not make any sense, you cannot fit them together. Therefore, why do you need to have a day that is 1,000 or 1,000,000 years long? Footnote. Some modern commentators, attempting to place the Genesis account within the evolutionary timescale, have tried in vain to show that the Holy Fathers believed the 6 days of creation to be vast ages. Those who have quoted St. John Damascene's mention of the seven ages of the world for this purpose have misinterpreted his meaning. The idea that world history is comprised of seven ages, corresponding to 7 days of the creation week, is an ancient one, found even in pre-Christian times. See Damien Thompson, The End of Time, pages 7 and 29, and Francis Haber, The Age of the World, pages 19 to 21. But according to this idea, the seven ages come after the creation week. Saint Simeon the New Theologian makes this clear in his discussion of the 6 days of creation and the seventh day of God's rest. God, as the foreknower of everything, arranged the whole creation in order and in an orderly sequence, and he assigned 7 days that they might be an image of the ages which were subsequently to pass in time. The first created man, page 90, emphasis added. St. John Damascene's own writings make clear that when he speaks of the seven ages, he is referring to world history after the creation week, for he says that the seven ages of the present world include many ages in the sense of generations of men. On the Orthodox Faith 2:1. This becomes even more evident in a later chapter of the same work, in which he writes specifically about the 6 days of creation, showing that he regards the length of these days, even the first 3 days, before the sun was made, as corresponding to the length of solar days, 365 of which make up the 12 months of the sun. On the Orthodox Faith 2:7. End of footnote. The Holy Fathers say again with one voice that the creative acts of God are instantaneous. Saint Basil the Great, Saint Ambrose the Great, Saint Ephrem and many others say that, when God creates, he says the word and it is, faster than thought. There are many patristic quotations about this, but we will not go into them here. None of the Holy Fathers say that the creation was slow. There are 6 days of creation, and they describe this not as a long process. The idea that the man has been evolving from something lower is totally foreign to any Holy Fathers. Rather, they say that the lower creatures came first in order to prepare the realm for the higher creature who is man, who must have his kingdom already created before he comes. Saint Gregory the Theologian says that man was made by God on the sixth day and entered into the newly created earth. There is a whole patristic teaching concerning the state of the world and of Adam before the fall. Adam was potentially immortal. As Blessed Augustine says, he was created with the possibility of being either mortal or immortal in the body, and he chose by his fall to be mortal in the body. The creation before the fall of Adam was in a different state. About this the Holy Fathers do not tell us very much, it is really beyond us. But certain Holy Fathers of the most contemplative sort, such as Saint Gregory the Sinaite, do describe the state of paradise. Saint Gregory says that paradise exists now in the same state it was in then, but that it has become invisible to us. It is placed between corruption and incorruption, so that when a tree falls in paradise, it does not rot away, like we see around us, but is turned into the most fragrant substance. This is a hint which tells us that paradise is beyond us, that some other law exists there. We know of people who have been to paradise, like Saint Euphrosius the cook, who brought back three apples from there. These three apples were kept for a little while. The monks divided them up and ate them, and they were very sweet. The account says that they ate them like holy bread, which means this had something to do with matter, and yet it was something different from matter. Nowadays people are speculating about matter and antimatter. About what is the source or root of matter, they don't know anymore. So why should we be surprised that there is a different kind of matter? Footnote. Elsewhere Father Seraphim quoted Professor I.M. Andrev of Holy Trinity Seminary on how matter changed at the fall. Christianity has always viewed the present state of matter as being the result of a fall into sin. The fall of man changed the whole of nature, including the nature of matter itself, which was cursed by God. Genesis 3:17. Andrev, Scientific Knowledge and Christian Truth, in St. Vladimir National Calendar for 1974. Page 69. See also Vladimir Lasky, The Mystical Theology of the Eastern Church, pages 103-4. End of footnote. We know also that there will be a different body, a spiritual body. Our resurrected body will be of a different kind of matter than we know now. Saint Gregory the Sinaite says it will be like our present body, but without moisture and heaviness. What that is we do not know, because, unless one has seen an angel, one has not had experience of this. We do not have to speculate about exactly what kind of matter this is, because that will be revealed to us when we need to know it, in the next life. It is enough for us to know that paradise, and the state of the whole creation before the fall of Adam, was quite different from what we know now. The law of nature we know now is the law of nature that God gave when Adam fell, that is, when he said, "Cursed be the earth for thy sake," Genesis 3:17, and, "In pain thou shalt bring forth children," Genesis 3:16. Adam brought death into the world, so it is very likely that no creature died before the fall. Before the fall, Eve was a virgin. God made male and female knowing man would fall and would need this means of reproducing. There is an element of great mystery in the state of creation before fall of Adam, which we do not need to pry into because we are not interested in the how of creation. We know that there was a creation of 6 days, and the Holy Fathers say they were 24-hour days. There is nothing surprising about this, that the acts were instantaneous. God wills and it is done, He speaks and it is done. Since we believe in God who is Almighty, there is no problem whatsoever. But how it looked, how many kinds of creatures there were, for example, whether there were all the different kinds of cats we see or whether there were 5 basic types, we don't know, and it's not important for us to know. Footnote. As Philip E. Johnson points out, the doctrine of creation scientists has always been that the God created basic kinds, or types, which subsequently diversified. The most famous example of creationist microevolution involves the descendants of Adam and Eve, who have diversified from a common ancestral pair to create all the diverse races of the human species. Darwin on Trail, page 68. End of footnote. To add to the theory of evolution the idea of God, as some Christian evolutionists do, gives no help at all. Or rather, it gives only one help. It gets you out of the problem of finding out where everything came from in the first place. Instead of a great tapioca bowl of cosmic jelly, you have God. That is more clear, it is a straight idea. If you have the tapioca jelly in space somewhere, it is very mystical and difficult to understand. If you are a materialist, it makes sense to you, but that is purely on the basis of your prejudices. But apart from this, the question of where everything came from begin with, there is no particular help to be derived from adding God to the idea of evolution. The difficulties in the theory are still there, no matter if God is behind it or not. The modern philosophy of evolution and orthodox teaching differ in the understanding not only of the past of man, but also of man's future. If the creation is one great filament which evolves and is transmuted into new species, then we can expect the evolution of Superman, which we will discuss shortly. If, however, the creation is made up of distinct creatures, then we can expect something different. We do not have to expect creatures to change or to rise up from the lower to the higher. Concerning the transmutability of kinds of creatures, The Holy Fathers have quite a definite teaching. The Holy Fathers use the word kinds, according to the word used in Genesis. Species is a very arbitrary concept, and we do not have to take it as a limit. Briefly, we will quote a few holy gathers about this. Saint Gregory of Nyssa quotes his sister Macrina on her deathbed, when she was speaking about this very question, opposing the idea of the pre-existence and transmigration of souls, which was taught by Origen. She says, in the words of Saint Gregory, "Those who would have it that the soul migrates into natures divergent from each other seem to me to obliterate all natural distinctions, to blend and confuse together in every possible respect the rational, the irrational, the sentient and the insensate. If, that is, all these are to pass into each other with no distinct natural order secluding them from mutual transition. To say that one and the same soul on account of a particular environment of body is at one time a rational and intellectual soul and that then it is caverned along with the reptiles, or herds with the birds, or is a beast of burden or a carnivorous one, or swims in the deep, or even drops down to an insensate thing so as to strike out roots and become a complete tree producing buds on branches and from those buds a flower or a thorn or a fruit edible or noxious, to say this is nothing short of making all things the same, and believing that one single nature runs through all beings, that there is a connection between them which blends and confuses hopelessly all the marks by which one could be distinguished from another." End of citation. This shows very clearly that the Holy Fathers believed in an orderly arrangement of distinct creatures. There is not, as Erasmus Darwin would have it, a single filament which runs through all beings. Rather, there are distinct natures. One of the basic works of Orthodox teaching is the Fount of Knowledge by Saint John Damascene. Footnote: this entire work is contained in Saint John of Damascus, Writings, the Fathers of the Church series, volume 37. End of footnote. This great work of the 8th century is divided into three parts. The first part is called On Philosophy, the second is On Heresies, which tells exactly what the heretics believed, and why we do not believe that, and the third part is On the Orthodox Faith, which is one of the standard books of Orthodox theology. In On Philosophy, Saint John begins with chapters which go into such things as what is knowledge? What is philosophy? What is being? What is substance? What is accident? What is species? What is genus? What are differences? What are properties, predicates? The entire Orthodox philosophy he presents is based on the idea that reality is quite distinctly divided up into different beings, each of which has its own essence, its own nature, and not one of them is confused with another. Saint John Damascene meant that this part be read, and this philosophy understood, before one undertook to read his book of Orthodox theology, On the Orthodox Faith. There are a number of basic books by Orthodox fathers which deal with the kinds of creatures. There are books called Hexameron, which means 6 days. These are commentaries on the 6 days of creation. There is one by Saint Basil the Great in the East, one by Saint Ambrose of Milan in the West, and other lesser ones. There are commentaries on the book of Genesis by Saint John Chrysostom and Saint Ephraim the Syrian, and there are many writings on these subjects scattered in the writings of many other holy fathers. The recent holy father Saint John of Kronstadt also wrote a Hexameron. These books are very inspiring, because they are not mere abstract knowledge, they are full of practical wisdom. The holy fathers use a love of nature and the splendor of God's creation to give examples for us human beings. There are many quaint little examples of how we should be like the dove in its love for its mate, how we should be like the wiser animals and not to be like the dumber animals, etc. In our own monastery, we can take an example from our squirrels. They are very greedy. We are not supposed to be like that. We should be gentle like the deer. We have all around us examples like that. In his Hexameron, Saint Basil quotes God's words in Genesis, "Let the earth bring forth." This brief command, says Saint Basil, was immediately a mighty nature and an elaborate system which brought to perfection more swiftly than our thought the countless properties of plants. Elsewhere, about God's commandment, "Let the earth bring forth vegetation," Genesis 1:11, Saint Basil says, "At this saying all the dense woods appeared, all the trees shot up, All the shrubs were immediately thick with leaf and bushy, all came into existence in a moment of time. In the ninth homily of his Hexameron, St. Basil has a quote on the very question of the succession of creatures, one after the other. He quotes Genesis, "Let the earth bring living creatures according to their kinds, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth." Genesis 1:24. St. Basil says about this, "Consider the word of God moving through all creation, having begun at that time, active up to the present and efficacious until the end, even to the consummation of the world. As a ball when pushed by someone, and then meeting with a slope is borne downward by its own shape and inclination of the ground, and does not stop before some level surface receives it, so too the nature of existing objects, set in motion by one command, passes through creation without change, by generation and destruction, preserving the succession of the kinds through resemblance until it reaches the very end. It begets a horse as a successor of a horse, a lion of a lion, and an eagle of an eagle. And it continues to preserve each of the animals by uninterrupted succession until the consummation of the universe. No length of time causes the specific characteristics of the animals to be corrupted or extinct. But, as if established just recently, nature, ever fresh, moves along with time." End of citation. This is a statement not of science but of philosophy. This is the way God created creatures. Each one has a certain seed, a certain nature, and transmits that to its offspring. When there is an exception, then it is a monstrosity, and this does not invalidate the principle of the natures of things, each one of which is quite distinct from the other. If we do not understand the whole variety of God's creation, that is our fault, not God's. St. Ambrose has a number of quotations along the same line. His Hexameron is very close to St. Basil in spirit. We have other quotes from Holy Fathers which show us a very interesting thing, that they were combating in ancient times something akin to the modern theory of evolution. This was the heretical idea that the soul of man was created after his body. The same idea is taught today by Christian evolutionists, although of course the ancient heresy based their idea on a misinterpretation of Genesis 2:7, "And God formed man of the dust of the earth, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Even today, Christian evolutionists seize on this passage and say, that means man was something else first, and then he became human. In ancient times, this false idea, that the soul was created after the body, was contrasted by the opposite, and equally false, idea of the pre-existence of souls. The Holy Fathers, in refuting both these theories, clearly stated that the soul and body of man were created simultaneously. Thus, St. John Damascene writes, "The body and the soul were formed at the same time, not before and the other afterwards, as ravings of Origen would have it." End of citation. St. Gregory of Nyssa goes into greater detail in refuting both heresies. First, he describes Origen's idea of the pre-existence of souls, that is, that souls fell down into our world. Some of those before our time who have dealt with the question of principles think it right to say that souls have a previous existence as a people and society of their own, and that among them also there are standards of vice and virtue, and that the soul there, which abides in goodness, remains without experience of conjunction with the body. But if it does depart from its communion with good, it falls down to this lower life and so comes to be in a body. Then St. Gregory describes the other heresy, which corresponds to the ideas of modern Christian evolutionists. Others, on the contrary, marking the order of the making of man as stated by Moses, say that the soul is second to the body in order of time, since God first took dust from the earth and formed man, and then animated the being thus formed by his breath. And by this argument they prove that the flesh is more noble than the soul, that which was previously formed and that which was afterwards infused into it. For they say that the soul was made for the body, that the thing formed might not be without breath and motion, and that everything that is made for something else is surely less precious than that for which it is made. End of citation. Surely his theory, although it is in a different climate of ideas, is very close to the modern evolutionist's idea that matter indeed is the first thing, and the soul is secondary. St. Gregory of Nyssa refutes this theory as follows. nor again are we in our doctrine to begin by making up man like a clay figure, and to say that the soul came into being for the sake of this. For surely in that case the intellectual nature would be shown to be less precious than the clay figure. But as man is one, the being consisting of soul and body, we are to suppose that the beginning of his existence is one common to both parts, so that he should not be found to be antecedent and posterior to himself, if the bodily element were first in point of time, and the other were a later addition. For we are to say that in the power of God's foreknowledge, according to the doctrine laid down earlier in our discourse, all the fullness of human nature had pre-existence. And to this the prophetic writing bears witness which says that God knoweth all things before they be. And in the creation of individuals, not to place the one element before the other, neither the soul before the body, nor the contrary, that man may not be at strife against himself by being divided by the difference in point of time. For as our nature is conceived as twofold, according to the apostolic teaching, made up of the visible man and the hidden man, if the one came first and the other supervened, the power of him that made us would be shown to be in some way imperfect, as not being completely sufficient for the whole task at once, but dividing the work and busying himself with each of the halves in turn. End of citation. Of course, the whole basis for an idea of evolution is that you do not believe that God is powerful enough to create the whole world by his word. You are trying to help him out by letting nature do most of the creating. The Holy Fathers also talk about what it means that Adam was created from the dust. Some people take the fact that Saint Athanasius the Great says in his writings, "The first created man was made of dust like everyone, and the hand which created Adam then is creating also and always those who come after him," and they say, that means Adam could have been descended from some other creature. He didn't need to be taken from literal dust. You don't have to take that part of Genesis literally. But it so happens this very point is discussed in great detail by many holy fathers. They come up with many different ways of expressing it, and make it absolutely clear that Adam and Cain are two different kinds of people. Cain was born of man, whereas Adam had no father. Adam was created of the dust, directly by the hand of Christ. Many fathers taught the same. Saint Cyril of Jerusalem, Saint John Damascene, and others. When we come to the question of what is to be interpreted literally in Genesis and what is to be interpreted figuratively or allegorically, the Holy Fathers set forth for us very clear teaching. In his commentary, St. John Chrysostom even points out in certain passages exactly what is figurative and what is literal. He says those who try to make it all allegorical are trying to destroy our faith. For the most part, the truths in the book of Genesis are on two levels. There are literal truths, and there are also, many times for our spiritual benefit, spiritual truths. In fact, there are systems of three or four levels of meaning, but it is sufficient to us to know that there are many deeper meanings in the scriptures, and very seldom is the literal meaning destroyed. Only occasionally is the meaning entirely figurative. In general, we can characterize evolution in its philosophical aspect as a naturalistic heresy, which comes closest of all to being the opposite of the ancient heresy of the or existence of souls. Footnote. Father Seraphim was using the word heresy figuratively here. Elsewhere he explained that evolution is not strictly speaking a heresy, but an ideology that is profoundly foreign to the teaching of Orthodox Christianity, and it involves one in so many wrong doctrines and attitudes that it would be far better if it were simply a heresy and could thus be easily identified and combated. End of footnote. The pre-existence of souls idea is that there is one kind of soul nature which runs through creation, while evolution is the idea there is one kind of material being which runs throughout creation. Both of these ideas destroy the idea of the distinct natures of created beings. The idea of evolution was a heresy that was lacking in ancient times. Usually orthodoxy is midway between two errors, for example, between the doing away with the divine nature by Arius, and the doing away with the human nature by Monophysitism. In this particular case, the other heresy, evolution, was not incarnated in ancient times. This heresy waited until modern times to make its appearance. We will see much more clearly the philosophical side of evolutionism when we look at a few of the so-called Christian evolutionists.